Well, earlier this year, we completed the journey through the first letter of John, 1 John, which we began at about the same stage of 2016. 1 John is a substantial letter, as you will know if you have been with us, and a very important one in the New Testament. The second and third letters of John, which we look at this morning and next Sunday, are much shorter and less often studied. I'd be interested to know whether you ever heard a sermon on 2 John. I don't think I have. I've certainly never given one. But these two letters come from the same hand as wrote the first and larger one, and they are the nearest thing in the New Testament that we find to a normal, typical piece of first century correspondence. They're probably just written on one sheet of paper, papyrus, as it would have been, just one sheet, and that probably accounts partly just for the length. Now, 2 and 3 John would seem to have been written when the first generation of witnesses to Jesus, what we call the apostolic generation, had pretty much all but died out. The earliest witnesses were no longer there to continue teaching and preaching and so on. And it is quite likely that John himself was the only one of the 12 apostles still living. And by that time, the church had grown and spread widely, and it was no longer possible to keep tabs on everything that was going on. And the kind of sort of careful, structured oversight that we find in the Acts of the Apostles is no longer really possible, could not be easily maintained. At the same time, the number of traveling teachers and missionaries and evangelists traveling around the ancient world was increasing all the time. And not all of those travelers, by any means, were as faithful as they should have been to the original teaching of Jesus. Not every message they brought rang true to the gospel of the apostles, sometimes deliberately, sometimes just through ignorance. And John's concern, presumably near the end of his life, is for the ongoing health of the churches that he knows, particularly as before, that they should be kept in those two vital qualities of truth and love, not one or the other, but both together. And you'll see that 2 John is addressed to a lady, the elder, to the elect lady, and to her children. It begins that way, and it concludes also with a greeting to this lady from her sister. The children of your elect sister greet you. And so, reading this, you and I probably ask, who are these intriguing anonymous ladies? It's clear that they are sisters. It's clear that they're married because they both have children. And it's clear that John has a close personal relationship with both of them. And most commentators agree that each of these two ladies is a personification of a particular local church. The church is spoken of in the New Testament in feminine terms as the bride of Christ. And so the children of this elect lady are members of the church to which he's writing. And John, the author, is the sort of superintendent, a sort of kind of prototype first century bishop, if you like, the superintendent with a sort of pastoral oversight of a cluster of churches in the region of Ephesus. So this is actually addressed to a lady. It is actually a letter to a particular church at a particular time that is well known to the author. What he does in this letter is to begin by describing the church in verses 1 to 3, and in the rest of the letter, he speaks quite candidly and from the heart about his concerns for her well-being. So let's begin by seeing verses 1 to 3, the church described. There are three things to note here in this opening little paragraph in John's description of this lady that is the local church. The local church, for first thing, is chosen by God. The lady is elect. It's only one word, and it's easy to miss it, but it is, of course, tremendously significant. A local church, that one and any other since, for all the ordinariness of its members, is much more than a purely human institution. It is Jesus himself who says, as recorded in Matthew chapter 18, I will build my church. The church is his. It belongs to him. He chose it. He forms it, he will build it. It is elect, it is his choice. And we do well to remember that. We sing about it sometimes, opening line of a hymn, Church of God, elect and glorious. That is accurate, and we do well to remember that. What a privilege to be among the chosen people of God. Amazing that he should choose people like you and me if we are believers in Jesus. Better rejoice in it. So the church is chosen. Secondly, it is formed by truth. Not just truth, but the truth. And the word truth comes five times in the first four verses. Christians, John reminds us, are people who know the truth. That's the phrase at the end of verse one, which is another way of saying people who know Jesus, because truth is a person. And in knowing him, we know the truth, and we know what is true. Truth comes in various forms, in various ways, of course. Scientific truth is discovered by experiment and research and inquiry and application of the mind to evidence and results, leading to certain conclusions and theories and so on, which is why some people say with varying degrees of dogmatism that only what can be demonstrated scientifically can be said to be true. And since you can't prove the existence of God scientifically, you can't be sure about it. It's not something you can know. But Christian truth is different. It's not found by experimentation and research. Christianity is not a religion so much as a revelation. And the truth of God has been revealed by God in the person of his Son. We'd not worked it out. We never could. But we have been shown it. Everyone has been shown it. John, at the beginning of his gospel, writes, "No one has ever seen God, but Jesus, his one and only Son, has made him known." The truth is there for anyone to look at who wishes to and find for themselves. And we note that this truth is absolute, it is the truth, it is permanent, and it is unchanging. And verse 2, the truth abides in us and will be with us forever. This is unchanging, permanent truth for today as much as for then, for the 23rd century as much as for the 21st. And it's truth that we can live and walk in. It lives in us, and we can walk in it day by day. So John the writer would have felt extremely uncomfortable if somehow he had been translated into our modern world, our postmodern world, which denies the very existence of truth or its accessibility to people like me and you. The modern world only recognizes multiple truths in the plural, which may vary from person to person. And John, being translated into our modern world, would be extremely uncomfortable. He would not be able to take that at all. This is truth that abides forever. And thirdly, the church is described here as being marked by love. The elder loves the lady in truth, and we walk at the end of verse 3 in truth and in love. And that's a reminder, if a reminder is needed, that truth and love are not incompatible. On the contrary, each depends on the other, or should. I suppose the sad reality is that as Christians we can easily overbalance in one way or the other depending on our personal temperament. Some Christian folk are very zealous for truth, and they can sniff out a heresy 100 miles away and pounce on it before it gets into anywhere near the front door. And I admire the zeal of folk like that. One could wish, though, for equal commitment sometimes to love. And then other Christian people, equally sincere, are full of love, but very quick with it to lay aside all doctrinal differences as if they don't matter, and to drown all distinctions in a kind of ocean of brotherly love. And that, too, one may admire while wishing at the same time for an equal commitment to truth. John says these two things go absolutely together. And he might remind us, I think, that truth can be hard if it isn't softened by love. But love can be soft if it isn't toughened by truth. And a local church is a place where these things are found together. A local church is a community, a special community of people God has brought together in a family, the lady and her children. And community is so rare these days, isn't it, in our individualized modern world. We were privileged to host a few weeks ago on a Friday evening here. It wasn't something we had organized, but we're glad to host an evening led on by Fegans, Child and Family Care, on parenting teenagers. It wasn't a specifically Christian event at all. They'd just emailed local schools, brief notice, if anyone wants to come to an evening on parenting teenagers, do come along, you'd be very welcome. They thought they might get 50 people. 300 people replied, and most of them came. And Ian, who was running the evening, said to me afterwards, you know, we're out there addressing these issues wherever we can in the world around, and yet we so seldom find community. There is a longing for community, and yet it is so rare. And a local church should be that community. And on Friday, just 2 days ago, in this very building, as we were reminded in our prayers, we held a service of thanksgiving for little Joseph Fraser, who was stillborn not long before. The church was pretty well full, and many people were with us who would never normally be here or go to any church or to a gathering of Christians, just busy doing other things. And one or two, I gather, very pleasant folk with us who are actually militantly anti-Christian, but wanted to come. Friends of the family wanted to be there, wanted to support, if possible, intrigued by what they would find. And it was great to have everybody here. And so many of those who are unfamiliar with Christian things were deeply touched by what they experienced. It was quite outside their normal experience, and they were trying, some of them, to understand it afterwards and talking about it. What was it that was so different about that gathering on Friday afternoon? It was surely the reality of truth and love. Those are the two things that explain our getting together. Truth and love. A deep conviction in the midst of pain and suffering of the truth of Jesus and the goodness of God, despite what you might think was evidence to the contrary. And along with that conviction of truth, a deep awareness of the love that exists between people who know God the Father and Jesus Christ the Son, and who, when one family from within the midst loses a child, the love of the brethren is very special and very real. Truth and love. That's the only way you can account for a gathering such as we had 2 days ago. This is reality, and it's very precious, and you won't find it anywhere else on this earth. There can only ever be love of that kind where the truth of Jesus is first recognized and believed. People long for love, but they'll only ever find it when they find the truth of Jesus. But when we are committed both to that truth of Jesus and to love for fellow believers, the world around just has to sit up and take notice. And that is a very special thing. This opening paragraph then should describe any local church, and not just the one that John is writing to. And he says in verse 3 that when Christians are united in truth and love, grace, mercy, and peace will be with us. There's lovely confidence there. Will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and in love. Now, good and beautiful as all that is, it cannot be taken for granted. John doesn't sign off at the end of verse 3 and say, see you folks, this is my letter. Much as he might wish to. Because he has to continue, because he knows that the life of any church is constantly under threat. And that is what he goes on to write about. We move from the church described in verses 1 to 3 to the church in danger in the rest of the letter. The church in danger. A local church can never afford to be complacent. And the dangers that John sees come from two places. From the human heart, inside, from one thing, and from wrong teaching from outside, from the other. And both of those are here. They're not in equal proportions. There is a danger, he says, first of all, from your own heart, from the heart of those to whom he is writing, and therefore from our own. There is danger to the local church from the Christian's heart. That may immediately be obvious in what he writes in verses 4 to 6, but I think it's there. John has a very pastoral heart. You can tell that. We've already known that. The first letter is full of pastoral love and care. And he says in verse 4, I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth. So it begins positively. It's always a good thing to do, isn't it? Especially if you've got something negative to say. He says the very positive thing first. It seems he'd recently paid a visit to this church, and what had caused him to be so happy, it was that he had found people walking in the truth. And that was not to be taken for granted. They might not have been. He had a genuine fear, no doubt, that some of them would have dropped out of the race for one reason or another. But actually, he's found, when he visited, just Christians, ordinary Christians, just keeping going, day by day, following Jesus, living for him. Nothing spectacular, nothing out of the ordinary, just what John Stott used to refer to as the discipline of daily dogged discipleship. And that's what he found, and it's what he heard of the church, and it was the best possible news to receive. And that's true, isn't it, for anyone who's got a pastoral heart, meaning simply if you care about the Christian life and fellow Christians. I don't know whether you, maybe there was somebody you knew a long time ago, if you are an old person, older person, maybe somebody who used to be very involved in their school Christian union with you or the youth group or at university or whatever. And since then your paths have diverged and you've lost touch, not been in touch maybe for many years, as inevitably happens in life. And then you meet someone years later who actually has came across that person whom you used to know. And you say, oh really, you know Anthony, do you? Oh really, how's he doing these days? Now, I have prayed for him a bit over the years, not much I'm afraid, you know, now it is, but I've occasionally just remembered him and prayed, how is he doing? And the reply comes, oh yeah, he's doing really well. He's really involved in his local fellowship, his local church, and he's a deeply servant-hearted Christian. Very, very committed, lovely wife to support and so on and so on. And you say, well that's wonderful, I'm so pleased to know that. I have wondered sometimes whether he'd keep going. But other things about Anthony are of interest too, whether he's married and got a family, where he's living and working and all that kind of thing. That's all very secondary to this first thing. Is he keeping going day by day? The discipline of daily dogged discipleship. And John's heard that they are, and he rejoices greatly. Maybe you are even better perhaps in some ways when you remember somebody who was very anti-Christian when you were at university with him or her, and then years later you discover that God has had mercy on them and they are now flat out for Jesus wherever they are, willing to suffer and to be laughed at and to be unpopular for him. And you think it's marvellous, children walking in the truth. So John begins positively, but then comes the reminder of the need for ongoing obedience, how we cannot live on yesterday's grace. I ask you, dear lady, verse 5, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, so that you should walk in it. The commandments, of course, are God the Father's commandments, not his, John's the apostle. And if love and truth belong together, and we've seen that already, and should never be separated, the same is true of love and obedience. Love and the commandments go together. And that's not a contemporary thing to say, is it? Because people today are very keen on love, or profess to be, they're not so keen on commandments. Love means different things to different people. But John says it is only when we are keeping God's commandments that we are actually walking in love. And the reality is that even the most sanctified Christian heart, in the most sanctified Christian heart, however long somebody has walked with Jesus, there will always be that constant tug towards disobedience to our dying day. And that is why John says what he says. We are to continue to walk in his commandments. And he keeps on saying, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm not saying anything new. Do you see how he keeps on saying that? It's not as though I were writing you a new commandment. This is the commandment. You heard it from the beginning. You've heard this at the beginning. Nothing new here. And we might say, well, why do you keep on saying it then if you've known it from the beginning? And the answer is, well, because you keep on forgetting. And you need constant reminders to keep to God's way together in your local church community. And often that has to do with little things, Most of life consists of little things, doesn't it? Big things come our way, but day by day, so much of it is about little things. And there's a lovely promise in the book of Isaiah, where the prophet says, you will hear a word behind you, saying, this is the way, walk in it, when you turn to the right or to the left. You will hear a word behind you, when you turn to the right or to the left, saying, this is the way, walk in it. Isaiah 30, 21. And that's not talking about what job you should do, what flat you should buy, what school you should choose for your kids. It's just a little daily touch on the tiller. When you're tempted to move to the right or to the left, you will hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. That daily touch on the tiller to keep you from falling into sin. There is danger from the most sanctified Christian hearts. And that surely is why we should take in something from God's word each day, if we are believers in Jesus, even if it's just a couple of verses from the Proverbs, on one of those Christian apps you can sign up for, or if it's just a moment in one of the Psalms, in those precious few minutes when your three-year-old is playing quietly and his little sister is asleep. A moment just to hear that word and be reminded, this is the way, walk in it. So there is danger from your own heart. And it's good to think of that first, because John has critical things to say about other people and warnings about other people. The first thing he addresses is here. But his main concern, and that's in verses 7 to 11, is with false teachers. This is his greater concern, because there are so many of them. He says in verse 7, many deceivers have gone out into the world. And there's so many of them and so much teaching. And what was true then, of course, is every bit as true today. And it's not good enough to say, therefore, as some today want us to say, that everyone who claims to be Christian is a faithful servant of Christ, just following him in their own particular way, which may be rather different. It is not good enough to say that, even though people are wanting us to. Because if there is truth, there is also untruth and error, and it matters very much that we know the difference. And false teachers always do one of two things. They rewrite or reinterpret the teaching of Jesus, either about himself and his identity, or about us and the sort of people we should be in following him. They rewrite the teaching of Jesus and of the New Testament. And whichever route they go down, whether it's about Jesus himself or about us following him, each one always affects the other. Wrong views of Jesus lead to wrong views of Christian living. And the teachers John has in mind and is bothered by are those who deny Jesus' teaching about himself and therefore the whole New Testament witness to him. He says in verse 7, they are those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. The Jesus of the New Testament, as we know, is fully God and fully man. And you'll have noticed that in verse 3, which is a lovely verse. Do look at verse 3 with me. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and love. The Father is not the Son, and God the Son is not God the Father, but both of them are fully God, and grace, mercy, and peace come from them both. But these teachers in John's day deny the full humanity of Jesus. They deny the incarnation. That's what they mean by the coming in the flesh. There was never really a human being, just pretended to be. Well, that is not unknown today, but much more common in our day. This is where the rubber hits the road with us. And certainly at the popular level is the denial of the full deity of Jesus. He is less than fully God. He who is recorded at the end of Matthew's gospel as saying, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And if all authority has been given to Jesus, then that means it hasn't been given to anybody else. But false teaching reduces that total authority to Jesus and brings it down a bit and says he has some authority, but not all. And that rewriting of his authority can be very, very subtle. It involves tampering often with what he actually said. Take, for example, what Jesus says at the beginning of Matthew chapter 7, judge not so that ye be not judged. If there is a saying of Jesus which is commonly quoted today, I think it is probably that one. Judge not so that you be not judged. And it's taken to mean you should never tell anyone that they are wrong. Judge not, that you be not judged. And to modern ears, that is music indeed. As long as what someone's doing isn't harming anyone else, no one has any right to say that it can be wrong. It's a very contemporary viewpoint. And if you doubt that, just think of the intense pressure that Tim Farron has been subjected to this past week. Judge not, so that you be not judged. But the journalists who've pummeled and bullied him make no pretense to be Christian. But if they were to approve of any part of Jesus' teaching, it would be this one. Judge not, that you be not judged. The trouble is, it's not what Jesus means. He was quite unafraid to tell clever people that they were wrong. What he does mean is this, that you and I are not to put ourselves on the pedestal as if people are accountable to us at the end of the day, as if we are the judge. That's what Jesus means. He does not mean you shouldn't distinguish between right and wrong and come to conclusions about such things. And he certainly doesn't mean that there is no judgment to come and that he, Jesus, will not be the judge. That rewriting of Jesus' authority involves tampering with his words and reducing what he's saying to something more acceptable. It's interesting to see how vicars are portrayed on screen these days. Rather different from how it used to be, when they're generally sort of bumbling figures of fun. Don't often see that sort of vicar on TV these days. In a recent TV drama series, it ended with a scene in church. The vicar is on the move. This is his last sermon. And people put on their Sunday best and respectfully troop in to listen. He's a very pleasant guy, single, in his early 30s, liked and respected in the community. And for his last sermon, a rainbow tapestry decorates the front of his pulpit. And his last word is to encourage the congregation, quoting the book of Hebrews, to spur one another on to love and good deeds. And then he adds that, I quote, "All any of us really want is love and good deeds." And the congregation sits there and nods thoughtfully. And David Tennant, shaking his hand after the service, says, "If I'd known you were that good, I'd have come more often." All any of us really want is love and good deeds. That's the vicar's parting message. But you see, if John had been there, I think he'd have waved his paw and said, "What about truth? You can't have love without truth. And if you won't hold to truth, love just disintegrates like a blancmange in a microwave. It can mean anything you want." And Jesus said on one occasion, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, but will not do what I tell you?" Truth and love belong together, they're inseparable. And the same is true of love and obedience. And John says, so many deceivers have gone out into the world. Watch yourselves so that we may not lose what we have worked for. False teaching can sound so reasonable, so persuasive. The unspoken question is always, how could anyone possibly disagree? But John's language is very direct. He writes in verse 9, as those who go on ahead and do not abide in the teaching of Christ. How do people go on ahead? Well, today they go on ahead by saying, well, we are contemporary modern people. The Bible writers were just men of their time. We have gone on ahead. We can't blame them for being what they were. But life moves on. We accept some of what they said, but not all of it. And we may even say that the Holy Spirit is leading us into new truth, more suited to our contemporary, modern understanding. John says, watch yourselves. Everyone who goes on ahead does not abide in the teaching of Christ, does not have God. He's very direct about that. Effectively, they leave God behind for all their claims to a better understanding. It is those who abide in the teaching, who stick with the truth of Scripture, who also stay close to the Father and the Son. It is people who stick to the truth of God's word who are able to sing, "All fairest beauty, heavenly and earthly, Jesus my Lord, in you I see." Verse 10 sounds rather rude. If anyone comes to you, does not bring this teaching, don't receive him into your house. Until you realize, of course, in the day says the church is met in people's houses. And the hospitality that we're not going for here is welcoming the false teacher into the pulpit, not just into the home. He might well be given a meal, but there's no way he should be allowed to speak. Whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. What a privilege, therefore, to belong to a community that is elect, chosen by God, formed by truth, and marked by his love. May that be true of the community to which you and I belong, and if we come from elsewhere, the one you represent this morning.